If you're rocking to get up and it's not a rocking chair, it's time for the Joint Relief Institute. Fast relief, covered by Medicare. 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
59 years ago today, worst snow ever in Chicago. Let's talk about that. Anna DeVlantis joins us for This Week in Chicago History. The Great Blizzard of 67.
Yeah, anyone who lived through it, Bob, will certainly recall it well, no matter how old you were. It may be brutally cold outside today, but that was the news headline. You're absolutely right. Worst snow ever when Chicagoans woke up this week 59 years ago. They probably didn't need to read the paper to figure that out, though. They could look right outside their window at the mountains of snow, the blinding winds whipping it all around, their car likely buried somewhere beneath several feet of snow and encrusted in ice. The blizzard of 67 was the storm everything before and after was pretty much compared to. You'd say, what's this like compared to 67? 23 inches of snow fell in a little over 24 hours, still the single storm record, I believe. 50 mile per hour winds, temperatures plummeted after the snow, giving the city that frozen tundra feel. And you'll probably recall, if you were alive then, that the city shut down. Public transportation came to a grinding halt, businesses shut down. Thousands of cars were abandoned, 20,000 on expressways alone, 1,000 CTA buses were just stalled out all across the city. People couldn't get anywhere, they weren't going anywhere, and they slept in their downtown office buildings because they couldn't get home. Some people walked miles to get home that day. And for a look back, we pulled a clip from Tom Skilling recalling the events of 67. Years later, he was not a TV forecaster then, of course. He was a kid delivering newspapers, he said. And back then, he recalled how the storm paralyzed the city, yes, but how predictive weather tools were just not at all what they are today, and how we completely missed the storm.
There's a famous picture of Lakeshore Drive taken in the middle of that blizzard, and it's like a parking lot, cars pointed every which way, and it's just hundreds and hundreds of abandoned vehicles.
Yeah, and it's hard to believe that you would be driving to work in the morning, right now, and they say, "Oh, some light snowfall expected today." No one predicted it. You just didn't have that capability back then. So
no. Well, we are celebrating the Super Bowl 40 years ago, aren't we?
Yeah, you know, Bob, okay, so it's 40 years ago. Hard to believe, first of all, if you just think about it. January 26, 1986, when the Bears won the Super Bowl and created all those lifelong memories. Most of us can recite the key players, the key plays from that game, you know, the fridge scoring a touchdown, the fact that Peyton didn't, the ferocious Bears defense, and the Buddy Ryan-Mike Ditka relationship, Richard Dent, the MVP. So many great memories we all remember, but we pulled some clips. The moments that many of us may not remember so well, a clip from the pregame show when they were describing the Bears-Patriots matchup before the Bears trounced the Patriots, of course, and then some pretty bold commentary during the game about Jim McMahon. You might not hear that kind of thing today. Finally, the last few seconds of the game when Mike Ditka and Buddy Ryan got carried off the field victoriously.
Dick Enberg and Merlin Olsen, I can still see Mike Ditka's sweater, can't you?
Don't you just love it with the stash and still, you know, replicated today? People dress up like that. Just kind of interesting, though, too, Bob. You think about the way, you know, we've been talking about it ever since. During that game, I rewatched a big portion of it, you know, to prepare here. And it's interesting how even the broadcast booth was talking about how it was pretty much over at halftime. You know, usually they try to talk it up to keep you interested. They're kind of like the Patriots are in survival mode, and
yeah,
kind of over.
Yeah, they said if it was a fight, it would have been stopped.
Yes.
Let's talk about Chicago. Well, it was Sears Tower that lost a title on this week in '88, right?
You know, it's interesting because you think about 98, Chicago Sears Tower was eclipsed as the tallest building in the world. That's when the Petronas Towers in Malaysia were completed. And it was a tough pill to swallow for our city. If you think back to that time, this was a source of great pride. You know, we had the world's tallest building status for 24 years since it was built and eclipsed the World Trade Center towers in 74, in the 70s. So here it was no longer the case. And, you know, you flash back to that time in Chicago history, and Chicago was really trying to make the argument that the Sears Tower was still the tallest because they were counting the spires on the Malaysian Tower, and that shouldn't count, Chicagoans thought. You shouldn't count the spires. So Chicago was unfairly being robbed, was this thing, and so was the thought. But that didn't fly with the Official Council on Tallest Buildings and Urban Habitats, the global organization that determines these things. The Sears Tower was still 33 feet shorter. The spires counted, and that's just the way it was. So tall was the Sears Tower, though, that Tom Skilling, we pulled this clip, too. This is awesome. He stood on top of the Sears Tower for a WGN TV news clip one time to do the weather from up there and explain how different things were at that elevation on top of the Sears Tower.
You know, it's hard to believe at one time the Prudential Building, the old Prudential Building, was the tallest in the city.
Yeah, and we had the number one and number two with the Hancock and Sears for a while, too. So it's, not the same today.
There is a Chicago connection to this song. Tell us about it, Anna.
You know, Bob, Barry Manilow, as you know, made that song famous. But a man from Peoria wrote it in January 1976. I Write the Songs was released as a single and became this huge hit, written by talented musician, Illinois native Bruce Johnston, a dedicated student of classical piano and later pop music, a true artist who became quite legendary in the music world himself. By summertime, that song climbed to number one on the Billboard 100 chart. Within a year, it won the Grammy for Best Song of the Year, one of Barry Manilow's breakout hits that helped solidify him as a superstar, still associated with him to this day. And he's in Vegas, I'm sure, performing that song. We pulled a clip from Barry Manilow speaking with Dean Richards on WGN-TV a few years back, talking about how Chicago played a special role in his career.
Yeah, Bruce Johnston worked with a lot of Chicago artists and producers. Didn't he?
He was very connected in the music world, but in Chicago as well, Bob. A Peoria native who became a member of the Beach Boys. He was so talented. Brian Wilson later hand-selected him to join the band at the height of their success. And so the Peoria native started writing about surfing and singing about surfing, although I'm not sure there's that much of it going on where he was from. He was just that talented that, he could pretty much do anything. Pretty incredible story.
Yeah. 6 years ago, what a sad story. Kobe Bryant, January 26th, actually, in 2020.
Yeah. 6 years ago, you're right, Bob. And his childhood idol, the reason we're mentioning this as part of it, his childhood idol was Michael Jordan, who memorialized him at his funeral during this time when the world tragically lost Kobe Bryant in that helicopter crash. You may recall that Michael Jordan could barely contain himself or hold back his tears as he talked about Kobe. He was a competitor, sure, but really, MJ said, Kobe was like a kid brother who would call him all the time and sometimes annoy him even, he joked about. But he wanted to break down every play after every game with him. But deep down, MJ talked about how he loved him like a brother. And Jordan said, when Kobe died, a piece of me died with him. That was pretty powerful. We pulled some of Michael Jordan's moving words in his very emotional speech from Kobe's funeral 6 years ago.
Yeah, that was quite something coming from Michael. And, of course, Kobe's daughter Gigi also tragically lost in that crash.
Very sad, very, very sad. But a very memorable moment from MJ there, and a light moment there when he referenced the crying Jordan meme that just broke the internet years ago.
We've talked about Chicago's candy history here a lot, and we've got another bit of history and a bit of honey to discuss.
That's right. Bob, I'm going to guess this is not one of your favorites, the bit of honey.
I have to tell you, we in the Albany Park neighborhood, we referred to this bar as a bit of, and it wasn't honey that we talked about. It was something else. Yeah,
you
a bit of blank.
It. Yeah. Well, it's interesting because it's super chewy and it's taffy-like and it got stuck in your teeth, and that's one of the reasons people probably didn't like it. But at the time, it was considered just this huge hit because at the time, pre-Depression and during the Depression and certainly post-Depression, it was a penny candy. So they had wrapped up this little chewy egg white honey formula with almond bits thrown in, and they charged you a penny candy. And that was made it affordable at a time when it was considered a luxury to get boxes of candy or even candy bars at that time. So this was an affordable thing, and it lasted a long time. That's why that you chewed it forever, and it still lasted a long time. But here, we pulled a TV ad, a retro TV ad that's kind of fun, a few years later, a couple decades later, actually, when it became a full candy bar. And this is the early ad for Bit O' Honey.
Yeah, thankfully it's gone now, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind of, well, it might be still around, but it was no longer a Chicago thing. Nestle bought it in 84. Oh. I don't know if you could still find the Biddle Honey. Not that you're looking for it, Bob.
No, I'm not. Anna DeVlantis, This Week in Chicago History. More next Wednesday. Thank you, Anna.
Talk to you then.